You are listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. Join him as he and his guests discover how businesses thrive in California.
Oh, welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405. We're going to be talking today with a young fellow who's been living the dream from Southern California. He and a partner started a company, a remote network management company, grew that company until it got to the place where it became a very lucrative target for a Boston roll-up. And now he is part of that Boston roll-up, managing about 60 people, doing the same thing he was doing before, but now having a lot more fun. So welcome, Aaron Beal, to the Pilgrim on the 405.
Thank you. I like the young fellow.
Young fellow, absolutely. Well, anyone these days is young fella to me. All right. So, Aaron, tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are today. Tell us a little bit more about that story I was just alluding to.
Sure. So, I think it was back in 1999. I started in the IT world, working for an organization called Dempsey Business Systems, and we sold computer hardware. Big mainframe systems, AS400, which are just large IBM expensive boxes. And at the time, the company was converting to a more of a model where they provided professional services, because they had the foresight to see the internet coming along and reducing the margins in that area. So they wanted to go sell professional services. So I was hired with a group of other sales reps to go out in the market and start drumming up professional service business. Now, I didn't come from an IT background. I came from an advertising background. So it was a big learning curve, learning the IT world. But that's what they sent me out in the marketplace to do. And then several years into that, the current owner decided he was going to sell. And he sold it to a gentleman who lived in Louisiana, who had owned several IT services companies. But he was in it for just really the turnaround, because at the time when the owner of Dempsey Business Systems had sold it, business was definitely down, at least on the hardware side. And I think the industry had just changed so much, and he just got to an age where he had enough. And so the gentleman who bought it in Louisiana turned it around, promoted me to sales manager. We did a great job, but he only wanted to be around for the turnaround. So when he went to go sell it, he offered it to me. I didn't have quite enough funds to buy it completely by myself, so we merged with another organization, another IT service company. So I ended up with a partner, and we became Dempsey Bluvar. Because they were Bluvar, we were Dempsey Business Systems. Neither of us were all that creative, so we came up with Dempsey Bluvar. And we ran that. We started from day one. We wanted to be what was called a managed service provider. I wasn't even sure exactly what all of that meant, other than what I wanted to do was create a reoccurring model. So I didn't have to start every single month at zero. And when you're out selling just hardware and projects, that's what it is starting every month at zero. A recurring model where someone paid us to provide on a contract support for a fixed fee per month seemed like a lot more sense to me. And that was kind of new thought in the industry, so I was probably one of the earlier adopters. And so we got going with that in, I want to say, 2005, 2006, grew that. And then if anyone listening to this has ever had a partner, you know that can be challenging, even if you like them a lot, which I did. But we just saw things differently, and an opportunity came along that we couldn't pass up to sell the organization. And my partner went to a different direction and went to go work for another great managed service provider. And I stayed on, and the company continued to acquire other managed service providers. And then after about the first year, and this was about 3 or 4 years ago, I was promoted to be the general manager of the managed service division, which really is about five or six different MSPs in California, Louisiana, Texas, New England area. So I got a large time zone to support now. So that's how I ended up here.
All right. All right. Well, tell us a little bit about tell us a little bit more about the stories of when you and your partner were growing Dempsey Blue Bar. What kind of challenges did you have and how did you overcome them?
Well, one of the first challenges was just this whole idea of supporting IT just operationally, right? Just understanding what it took to all the components of supporting someone's IT, from help desk to security management, which includes things like patch management and monitoring their backups. And at the time, a lot of the tools that you would use to do this were pretty new to the industry, at least tools that allow you to support multiple clients. So there was one, an operational challenge of figuring that out. And there wasn't a lot of people you could go to or look to as an example, because there just wasn't that many large managed service providers or IT ones in the market. And then a second challenge was just the whole financial component. So I had not owned a business before, so just going through financials and making decisions and reading your balance sheet, making sure you had enough cash flows and meeting your covenants was a whole challenge. And then third, going out to sell a product or service in which no one had heard about, or very few people understood the concept of outsourcing your IT. And so larger organizations, maybe in the Fortune 2000, but not really in the SMB market. So going out and educating prospects on why they would want to outsource their IT and come up with a sales methodology around that was a challenge. So those were the three biggest challenges.
All right, so talk a little bit about the operational challenge. How did you wind up solving that?
One of the key components, well, obviously there was figuring out what you should do and writing the policies and procedures to make that happen. But I would say bigger than that was understanding how to hire A player engineers. And the engineers we had at the time, while some of them are pretty good, they were really more project engineers. They weren't day-to-day support engineers. So trying to find that perfect mix of A player engineers to support the environment and just learning how do I go out and hire the best people? What does that look like? How many people do you interview for a position? Should we buy these personality profile picks? Are they good? What type of skill sets should this person have? Now imagine I'm interviewing senior technical people on skill sets that I don't even possess myself. I mean, I came from outside the industry as a salesperson, right? So I had to become a lot more technical, really just on my own time, at least conceptually. So I would say the bigger challenge that took me years to get better at, and I'm still, I don't know if I ever really fully arrived, but is the figuring out how to hire A players.
So what have you learned about hiring A players? I mean, I heard you say an important piece was, maybe a couple of important pieces. One was getting really clear on what you're looking for.
Correct. So you want to know and define what it is you want. Do you want more of a driven, proactive person? Do you want someone who, let's call them more of an operator, who may not necessarily be proactive, but can sustain doing the same thing all day over and over again? Are we looking for a specific skill set, someone who's more general in their technical knowledge? So, yeah, so one you have to define. You have to, if you really in particular want the A players, you have to be a good place to work as best as you can make it. And so you have to answer the difficult questions is, well, why would someone even work for you? Mm-hmm. Why would they work for your organization? We often spend a lot of time talking about, why would this client buy from me? But I think before you figure out why your clients might want to work, buy your services or your products, is why would A players in the marketplace come work for you? And I really struggled with that. I mean, I would sometimes interview A players and I was caught off guard by that, right? Just not owning a business before and the type of questions they would ask. And some certainly some of their expectations early on, it was difficult to meet those. I mean, when we started the company, there were, you know, four of us, right?
Right.
So it was a long multi-year learning experience.
Well, it would seem to me that one of the pieces is if you want to have A players, whether they're A players, salespeople or engineers, but if you want to have A players working with you, you have to have an A level management process to be able to support them, right?
You do. I mean, you're going to need to set the example from a cultural standpoint, right? Because the leadership of the team, so goes the leader, so goes the team. So if the leadership culturally, work ethic-wise, are not doing what they expect their employees to do, then I don't think you make it too far.
Right.
You have to have your own act together first.
All right, so you learned how to deal with the operational challenges. You began hiring A player engineers who were also able to support on a regular basis, rather than just develop new products and services. These were people who were going to support those companies who had a relationship with you, so you're supporting them remotely. What about the financial component? How did you learn how to manage the financial component of your business?
Well, my recommendation, if that's a struggle for anyone listening, is to hire and go out and find an A player CFO. So that was clearly going to be a weakness of mine. So I was lucky enough in this case, not because I went out and went through the correct process to find a great CFO. I was just lucky to get one. And it's the same CFO that we still have today. And he's fantastic. He spent the time to educate. He's got some great visionary skill sets beyond just counting the numbers. So over the years, he's just been very patient. And unfortunately for him, he had to be patient. Because at first, particularly being a salesperson, in my mind, I could sell myself out of every situation.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the problem is, well, I'll just sell more. And I would not pay attention to some of the, I guess you would call it, expenditure leakage that would happen all over the place. Administrative stuff was not my strength. I was a sales guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I had to grow myself, and luckily I had a great CFO. So, you got to have a good CFO.
Right. Well, all right. Now, this would be an example of taking something that what I heard from you is you recognize this was not something that you were good at. You might
Correct.
Be able to do, but you weren't good at it. And also, you probably didn't want to do it, right?
No, particularly at first, I would say in particular in his first 4, 5, 6 years, I did not pay attention to the numbers as much as I should have. Not always heeding the advice of my CFO. Now, many years later, I'm all about managing every single number. Everything I do is based on a number. But early on, if I could save anyone else from making some of the mistakes I have made, would be to take the time, regardless of your background, whether you're comfortable with numbers or not. But if you're going to own a business, you got to know your numbers.
Mm-hmm. And this is also an example of delegating and elevating, right?
It is. Certainly. Which was another challenge of mine as well. Not so much on the financial side, but in other areas in the business. And it's still an issue that comes up for me occasionally today, although I'd like to at least think I've improved a lot. And that is, in my mind, if I'm capable of doing it, no one can do it better than me. So often, and historically, I've been known to delegate something to someone. And the moment I believe they're struggling at all, I just go grab the football away from them and go do it myself.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of slowing down and really doing the elevate and delegate correctly, I'm more likely to grab the football from you. So it's taken a lot of biting my lip at times and being patient to slow down to do that elevate and delegate. That's been one of my challenges as well.
Well, and what are the advantages of doing this elevating and delegating?
Well, here's what I can tell you what's not going to happen for you if you don't. Your organization will always completely center around the leader. In other words, if you take off, the whole thing just crumbles. If you're not involved in everything, your business doesn't function. So you're not really a company. You're just, a sole person. You know, you might have some assistants, but you don't really have a company. So I don't think you grow very large or hit large profit numbers with 10 to 20% growth year over year if you don't figure out elevate and delegate and hiring A players. You just don't. Believe me, I've tried. if I could do it all myself, I would do it, but it doesn't work like that.
Well, you don't really have a company. I think that was what it was.
You don't really have a
team,
no.
Right?
Yeah.
All right, so we talked about operational challenges. We talked about learning the financial component, which means finding somebody and not only turning things over, but listening to them and trusting them and wanting to learn from them. And then the third thing was selling services to in a marketplace where you were really some of the cutting edge, some of the early adopter kind of experiences for people. So how did you deal with that?
Yes. So yeah, there was two components of it. So it was going out into a marketplace to sell a service that was a little difficult for most of our prospects to, at first anyway, to wrap their heads around. And then it was also going from, selling somewhat transactionally to more of a consultative sale, right? So if I'm selling you a limited time project to get you from A to B and it's X amount and it's going to go for 2 weeks, while there are some consultative aspects to it, it's not nearly to the same degree as, give me the keys to the kingdom to run your IT department and come in and be your virtual CIO, your security officer, your help desk, monitor everything 24/7. Because think about most business owners, they're not senior IT people, whether you're a bank, whether you're healthcare, whether you're finance company or manufacturer or distributor. Those typically aren't run by strong technical IT people. So there's a lot of trust you have to put in us and sign multi-year agreements. So that's a very consultative, often multi-month sales process. So there was two challenging components of it to overcome.
Well, all right. So when you were solving the operational issue, you begin to look at A players and you begin to attract them, get the specific engineers that you needed who were A engineers and able to do support. You, in solving the financial component, you found maybe you lucked onto them, but nevertheless, you had an A player CFO that you could trust and learn from. Where did you learn? Who did you turn to learn how to sell in this marketplace?
We did okay for a while, just based on our own experience selling. But some years ago, and I don't even know what year it was, you may remember, we came across the Sandler sales system. And that was extraordinarily helpful because one of my big challenges had always been not necessarily winning deals, but not understanding why we won them. And when we lost them, why we lost them. And I could certainly never articulate to someone else what they would need to do to win a managed service opportunity for IT outsourcing. The number of people that are able to do that kind of sale are pretty limited. And even if you're a good salesperson, trying to get you up to speed without some type of process to sell managed services is nearly impossible. So running across the Sandler sales system, which structured the sales process in such a way that we knew where we were in the sale, everyone could communicate at the same level, whether you were on the operational staff or business development, we were on the same page. We understood when the sales process was going off or when it was on track and why we won it and where we lost it and where, in many opportunities, where we shouldn't spend the time. Because selling managed services is certainly one of those things. It's very helpful to know when to back out of an opportunity, and the earlier you can back out, the better. And I know there's probably other sales process methodologies that you could subscribe to that are just as good. I don't know. My only recommendation is that you find one that you can work from. Just like you need an operating system on your desktop, just like you need an operating system to, of some type to run your business from an operational standpoint, you need that for sales as well. I think many business owners make the mistake of, hey, I'll just hire some salespeople and, you know, give them a phone and they'll figure it out. You wouldn't run your operations that way. You probably wouldn't hire accounting people that way. You certainly don't want to hire salespeople that way.
Excellent. So you found the Sandler selling system and began to understand it yourself. And then also you use that to train your, well, help to select the new salespeople and then to train them, right, on an ongoing basis.
That is correct.
Yeah. And and the effect of all of these three was, if I remember sometimes when you were talking to me, your business quadrupled over a period of time because you had the right engineers, you had somebody watching the numbers, and you had a selling system that worked.
That's right. And there's no way that without these systems, we could have done the kind of roll-up we did. I think three out of six, or at least half of the acquisitions made were pretty upside-down organizations. So without a proper process in those areas, we couldn't have turned them around in the period of time we did, which was, 12 months.
That's excellent. I mean, I'm really happy to hear the kind of systematic approach that you took to your early business with Dempsey Bluvar. We're going to take a little break here and hear from our sponsors, and then I'm going to come back and I want you to tell me in the post roll-up phase when you were purchased and now you're the general manager of this much larger company. I want you to talk about the systems that you're using now, okay?
Sure.
Well, we'll be right back with the Pilgrim on the 405 talking with Aaron Beal.
Hi, time for another tip from the Sandler Sales Institute. Prospects want your information and expertise. Prospects have been trained by the vast majority of salespeople to feel entitled to your valuable information. Most salespeople are comfortable in coughing up their expertise for free. However, when the orders don't come and the prospect has shopped your information to your competitor, the salesperson has fallen victim to unpaid consulting. Before giving information, ask good questions. What does the prospect want? What is the urgency? What are the consequences of not buying anything? What is the decision-making process? Eliminate unpaid consulting. This has been another Sandler Sales Institute tip.
All right, back to Will and his guest.
Well, here we are with Pilgrim on the 405 talking to Aaron Beal, who had a lot of fun building a company with systems and operations and finance and then in sales and marketing. And now we're going to take the next step. Your company is purchased by this roll-up folks from Boston. And then after a year, you wind up being the general manager for the same thing that you were doing before, but now you have four or five companies to integrate. Is that right?
That's correct.
So tell us a little bit about the systematic. What did you discover? Tell us the story about this whole thing called the entrepreneurial operating system and how that figured into the mix.
Sure. So I got to tell you, the process was difficult. The first 3 months were a little bit overwhelming. You know, you're talking about different phone systems, different tools to track tickets and projects. At least the back-end accounting was the same, but much of the front-end stuff was completely different. So the systems was one piece. And, that, you know, when it comes to systems, that's a pretty, I won't say simple, but, you know, you can come up with a design and figure out how to get to A and B. I'd say the biggest challenge really was just the cultural one, right? So every organization has a different culture. Whether is it a culture where people typically work as islands with a group of clients? Do they work as more of a collaborative team? What are the politics within that organization? And every managed service provider that was acquired had a slightly different culture. And some of them were quite a bit different. You know, coming in and trying to force a particular culture down people's throat is pretty challenging, and so I didn't do that. I didn't want to impede the success of some of the groups just because their culture was a little bit different than their neighbor in another state. But one of the things that certainly helped that we prescribed to early on when I got into this position, right at the time I became general manager, thank goodness, was the entrepreneurial operating system. Which is a really just a guideline set of instructions that are very specific to run your business primarily from an operational standpoint, although it certainly touches on sales and marketing as well. So I bought into that hook, line, and sinker because I knew that I don't know if this was the best operating system of its type out there in the marketplace, but I recognized it as certainly very good. So we got a consultant for it who took us through the process. It was challenging to deploy, but, you know, because you have to think through a lot of stuff. I mean, we had to think through, you know, what makes us unique as a whole, not just as a location, specific locations, but what makes us as a whole unique. Why are we different? Who is our target market? And I was in very different markets, and so it was difficult to figure out, you know, small town market versus big city, and this is different. Coming up with a 1-year plan and a vision for 5 years and 10 years and, what our core values are, and then communicating those core values and making them mean something. I mean, it's one thing to come up with some core values and then send everyone an email, but trying to adopt that in such a way that it's actually an effective tool is another. So, I mean, that took time. It's a process, and I don't know if it ever ends. It's always ongoing. And then another part of this particular entrepreneurial operating system, they have something called EHAN, which stands for Everyone Has a Number. Now, that is one thing that it took me a while to adopt, and Everyone Has a Number just means that everyone in the organization, regardless of their position, whether they're secretary in the front, or they work part-time, or they're a key player, everyone has at least one number, and often multiple numbers, to that they can see their own performance as real-time as possible, and obviously a lot of the performance is judged on that. And that was a difficult thing to deploy. I think I pretty much did not a great job in the first year deploying it. It was one of those things where I got it out there, but didn't really use it as a tool, and it wasn't until last year sometime that we really started getting people engaged in everyone having a number. And the effects of it were just incredible. Once we got pretty much the whole staff, because there's always a couple stragglers, but once we got 99% of the staff really focused on those numbers, and those numbers meant something to them, and they understood how they played a key role in the organization, and made a big difference as far as profit per account, engineer utilization, and of all the things in that system, in the EOS system, I would say Everyone Has a Number probably had the biggest effect on us. So whether you participate in a system like that or not, making sure that everyone has performance numbers and they know what your core values are, and you're able to kind of make those sticky in the organization and mean something, you'll get a lot out of it.
So now you talked about core values. Core values, is that something that the owner of the company said, these are the core values we're going to have? Did you vote on them? How did you come up with the core values for the company?
So we got together as an executive team, and we looked at some of the people who we believed who are our top A players in the organization, right? And we thought to ourselves, okay, what values do those people have? I mean, we have this guy, say, John Doe, just making up a name, who our clients love, who always has great utilization, great profitability, generates a lot of revenue, seems very client-focused, provides excellent work, always shows great integrity, and is very compassionate. Those are really great values, and that seems to work very well in our organization. So we should have those core values. So that's how we did it. We looked at the kind of people in the organization that we wanted everyone else to emulate.
And then those become your core values. And once you have them, does everybody just automatically become them?
No. That would be cool, though. So we've just gone through a process of, one, communicating over and over again what they are in various different mediums. We have a newsletter that comes out every month where people nominate what we call rock stars. And you nominate people based on being a great example of one of the core values. And then if a particular group or a person has enough rock star nominations, they can win lunch or prizes, that kind of thing. As part of every employee's annual performance review or quarterly performance reviews, however often you have them, a big part of that review is how you align to those core values, right? And if you have any type of bonus plan, well, that's a part of it, right? How well you were an example of those core values. When people have questions, we're always pressing ourselves, everyone in management, and when they come to me with a question, and if I can answer that question by saying, well, what is our core value? And they go, well, this is our core value. Well, based on our core values, what do you think we should do in this situation? Well, I think we should do this. Okay, then that's what you should go do. Again, if you want to scale your organization and have people be interdependent, then core values is a key component of making that happen.
How important are core values when you're looking to hire folks?
Very important, obviously. So we have structured a set of quite a few interview questions per core value. So we have anywhere from 4 to 8 questions per core value. So they're questions that, you know, we'll ask you, and, you know, based on the answer, did your answer meet our core value? Now, we don't tell prospects who are applying here what our core values are until after we've done the interview, so we can get a sense of where they are. So we try to use them in that way as well.
Well, how important are core values when, let's suppose, I'm thinking out loud now, let's suppose you have somebody who's a very, very, you mentioned engineer, a very, very good engineer, but they really don't share your core values. What would that do? What would you do
with
that?
They don't work here. It doesn't matter. They won't work here. So there's a lot of great people in the marketplace, but culture is king.
Are you saying you would actually fire somebody if they didn't share your core values?
Yes, and we have.
You have?
Yeah.
Did they understand why they were being fired?
I hope so. We explained it to them. We put it in writing.
Even though they were very, very good at their particular job?
Yeah, they might have been very great in a particular area, but we can't operate a machine this size and scale it without everyone having similar values. It doesn't work. I've tried. It doesn't work.
Well, let me go the other way. Let's suppose you had somebody who was really, really in sync with your core values. Would you accept them being a B player engineer rather than A player because they had the values?
Yeah. So we have people in our organization today who are B players, but they're great examples of core values. And I think in some of those situations, it's really upon us to help those people to go from a B to an A player. In other words, you know, it's easy to sit back as a manager and go, well, this is what's wrong with my employees. But I think you need to look in the mirror as well, because if you have people who are really a great example of your core values, and those core values are correct, and they're giving 100%, in our minds, at least in the way we operate, we owe it to them to try to elevate them to the next level.
Okay. Well, now, often I, in working with businesses, I hear them talk about the, you know, the difficulty they have with meetings. So just meetings that don't seem to get any place. They talk about trying to make decisions and problems, and sometimes they never get solved. What? How does that work in your organization?
I'll say this to start off. Regardless of how effective your meetings are, if you have a big enough organization, there'll probably always be a few whiners, but at times. But part of the entrepreneurial operating system, they have a format for meetings called a level 10, and it's called a level 10 because that's how you score it. A great meeting is a 10 out of 10. But it provides a specific agenda with very specific purpose, with very specific time limits, and certain times a week to have a meeting, because meetings can go off into rabbit holes or left with a lot of loose ends that aren't followed up on. And people feel like time is wasted. So that when you say, you know, there's a lot of general feeling out there that meetings are a waste of time. Well, I would agree there probably are a lot of meetings that are a waste of time. But if you adopt something like the EOS system, where you have a specific agenda that goes over numbers, scorecard, that gives people an opportunity to all speak, share some good news, bring issues to the table to be identified, discussed, and solved in a format where nobody is superior. So the way we run level 10s is when these meetings is when, even though I might be the general manager, and I may have a lot of people in a meeting that report to me, in that meeting, you know, in a lot of ways we're equal. And we stress that because one of the challenges that you have is you're always going to have a group of employees that feel a certain way about something. Something should be done differently, for example. And they may be right. They may have some issue with a person or process. That's a real issue. But if they don't feel comfortable bringing it up, they won't. So I think the other thing that having this agenda in the EOS level 10 meeting that helps is it gives people better comfort level to bring up issues that maybe they wouldn't have otherwise. Because if you've ever run a company with a lot of people for a long time, with a lot of clients, one of your biggest pet peeves, or at least it's mine, is coming across some type of landmine, some issue that has been sitting out there for months and months, and you didn't know about it because no one said anything. And it's so much more difficult to handle and so much more expensive when you're trying to handle the back end of a problem before heading it off, before it becomes a problem. So having a level 10, not only does it reduce the complaining about wasting time in a meeting, it greatly reduces it, but more importantly, it provides a format. It's provided a format for us to recognize potential issues earlier on before they get too out of control.
So in this level 10 meeting, does somebody call it to just decide we're going to have one today? What happens?
So they're typically once a week at the same time, same place, and they're 90 minutes.
90 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
So that 90 minutes is people get tired after 60 minutes and decide that this is a waste of time?
That typically doesn't happen. Now, there are some levels. So at every level, every single person in our organization is in a level 10 meeting, except for a few managers. Really, no one's in more than one level 10 per week. And some of those level 10s, particularly at, you know, the help desk level where you have, you know, younger people, first job, some of the lower level administrative people, those level 10s sometimes are a little shorter. Maybe sometimes they're more scheduled every other week. But either way, you know, typically most people don't go to certainly more than one of those per week.
So you're telling me that you're, if I hear you correctly, that your senior managers, your leadership team meets every week, same time, same day, starts on time, ends on time, and it's 90 minutes long.
That is correct.
Wow. And you follow the same agenda every time.
Same agenda.
So is there any other meetings that you have in addition to this weekly Level 10 meeting?
The only scheduled meetings are with individuals, so these are one-on-ones.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the best education that you can provide your staff is that one-on-one attention. But those don't need to be an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on the role of the staff member, maybe it's weekly, maybe it's once a month, but they can be 5 minutes to 30 minutes. But giving people that one-on-one instruction, encouragement, attaboys, constructive criticism, and a regular, you know, that has a specific agenda as well. But having that one-on-one time is critical.
So now, what other aspects of EOS have you found particularly helpful in running this organization for you? Your organization has 60 people that report to you, right?
Yeah, a little less than that, but yeah, just about 60.
All right, so what other elements of EOS have you found particularly helpful?
The other big element is there is a what's called a quarterly meeting. And the quarterly meeting, typically, depending on the level of management you're at my level, those meetings, we do them 2 days per quarter. So we go offsite somewhere, and for 2 days, we lock ourselves down. First day, you can do some phone and email because it's more of a state of the union on where each group is at. So sales, operations, financials, we go over kind of where we're at and where we've come from. And day number two is no phone, no internet, no email, 100% focused on identifying issues, solving them, and identifying the key, maybe 2 to 10 things that we need to get accomplished over the next 90 days. And those are called rocks, and they're specific, they're measurable, and they're attainable within 90 days. And they're the things that are the most important to push the company forward. And then every week, you report where you're at on getting that done in the normal weekly meeting. So those things have a high priority and high visibility. And they're designed to push you either personally forward or something to push the company forward.
So the first day is reporting on what happened last quarter, where we are, what we've accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second day is identifying what the problems are, what the real problems are, discussing them, coming up with solutions, and then out of that, setting these 90-day goals.
That's right.
And has that been effective?
Super effective. Super effective. Because I wish I would have run across this when I owned my own business, because, again, I was really more of an army of one to some degree that I described. And I think without the EOS system, I don't know if I would have overcome my issue of trying to do it all myself. The EOS system kind of forced me out of that habit.
Wow. Excellent. Well, we just have a little bit of time left. What advice would you give companies that were not particularly startups, but where you were with Dempsey Bluvar? You had between 10 and 250 employees, right?
Mm-hmm.
What advice would you give them right now?
Get some good people around you. You got to find A players. You have to take the time. I had a real issue with having what I call happy ears and hiring the first person I met who I thought who could do it. Hire very slowly. Take the time to interview a lot of people, even if you think you got a great candidate. So slow down to pick good people. Build your operations and your sales process and the processes to operate your business, whether you use a Sandler, an entrepreneurial operating system, or use something else. identify some of those methodologies early on and adopt them as best you can when you're smaller. So, because if you, I mean, how do you get from 5 million to 10 million to 20 million in your service company? Is you can't do that without having systems built around you with a lot of people engaged in those systems in order to scale. So it may not seem like you need to do that when you're less than 10 people because you can kind of do it all yourself. But I can promise you, you'll never get past that until you start adopting some systems around you.
Excellent. Excellent advice for companies that are in that middle stage toward moving towards success, from coming out of the, you know, the first 2 or 3 years of startup and all of that, where everybody's running around with their hair on fire, to when now we begin to put systems in place as we create the foundation for what we have in mind as 5-year, 10-year, 20-year success points.
That's right.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Aaron. And I know that the people out there who are listening will give you lots of thanks, too, for helping them to see what's available to help businesses in California thrive. So if people want to talk with you, Aaron, how can they get in touch with you?
You can call me.
How would they call you?
They can call me at 714-352-8060.
Once again?
714-352-8060.
Thank you very much, Aaron, for being part of not only part of the show here, but also being part of partners that you and I have established over, my goodness, 6, 8, 10 years, something like that.
That's right. Long
well,
time.
Congratulations on all the great success that you have.
Well, thank you for all your help over the years.
Well, good. Well, this is the Pilgrim on the 405. Listen to people like Aaron Beal and others who have made this pathway from a vision, a smaller vision, to a much larger vision by using systems and using other people, really following this whole idea of elevating yourself and delegating those things that you might be good at but really don't want to do. So this is the Pilgrim on the 405, wishing you a great day, and help all businesses thrive in California.
You've been listening to the Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. To hear more of the programs in this podcast, go to www.willcrist.com.